You didn't hear what she just said to me. She said, now be nice. My name is Judy Pearson. I'm a very grateful alcoholic. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
I want to thank the committee and whoever else is responsible for getting me here. I like Texas. I love Texas. I like Texas AA, Texas people. And this is a weekend that I have needed for myself. It even talks to us about that in the big book that sometimes we need to do this. And it was just one of those times for me that I needed to be around the people that I love best. And I needed to be around them exclusively. And I've been able to do that thus far this weekend, and it's been wonderful. So I'm very, very grateful to you. I'm grateful to whoever made the little fruit baskets that are in our rooms. I think that's just such a nice gesture, and I thought it was particularly thoughtful that you put low-fat candy bars in there. Just thought, oh, that's wonderful. So I sat down and ate every one of them. Yeah. I quit smoking in December. So don't applaud for that. I don't know how long that's going to last. But at any rate, I've always had a love for chocolate. However, since December, it's increased tenfold. But I am grateful to be here, and I do thank you. And I'm going to go back to the instructions so I can kind of get my bearings here. The instructions in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened and what we're like today. Okay, and it doesn't, and please don't misquote it as what it used to be like, because that's not what the book says. It says what we used to be like. So I'm going to tell you what I was like. I do have a drunkalog. I think that it's real, real important, and this is my own personal opinion, it's real, real important for the newcomer to know what I looked like and what I acted like and what I was like when I drank. You know, I want you to know that I am qualified to be up here talking to you about alcoholism. I want you to know that I know what it is like to take a drink in the morning in order to get the heart pumping. Okay? I also want you to know that when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 23 years old. I have not gone back out. Okay? I want to share with you it is not necessary that you have a relapse. And I was a daily drinker, and I was a barroom brawler. So if you're looking for a ladylike story, you're at the wrong place. I talked one time in Georgia. Georgia's actually what I call my home state. But I talked one time in Georgia, and after I got through with my talk, a lady came up to me, and she said, Judy, I liked your story very much, and I appreciate very much your honesty, however, and I knew it was coming. Couldn't you clean it up a little bit? And I thought, you know, that's back when I was really open-minded. And I thought, okay, I'll take a look at that. You know, maybe there's something I can clean up. So I started going through my story and started getting rid of the parts that weren't too dainty, you know. And I found out that I would have to stand before you for 1 hour absolutely mute because there'd be nothing left to my story. You know, and I think what that says to me and what it should say to a lot of us is alcoholism is not a clean disease. There's nothing pretty about our disease, people. There's just nothing pretty about our disease. You know, we laugh here, thank God we can. Thank God we can, and that's who we need to thank. But there is nothing pretty about active alcoholism. There is nothing clean about active alcoholism. And in all the joy that we share here this weekend, let us not leave here thinking it was just an AA weekend. Let us remember what this thing is really about, because it is so easy to get lost. I came into this world a Polish Catholic, so I knew I was going to be here. I had the thought when I first got here that I was going to be the only Catholic in Alcoholics Anonymous. And God is so wonderful the way He does things. Because the first speaker I heard in Alcoholics Anonymous was a priest. Isn't that incredible? And you know how, if you're a Catholic, you know this to be true. If the priest can do it, you can do it. It's okay. Yeah. My mother, as I said, divorced my father. My father was not a well man mentally. And when he got back from World War II, He never really got any better. It just was worse for him. And he became a ward of the state of Michigan, and he was to remain a ward of the state of Michigan for the remainder of his life, till he died when he was 68 years old. My mother remarried, and she brought into our lives a new alcoholic, a blossoming alcoholic. And I want to tell you that I love the man very much, and he was a good father at first. I have one of those stories, and I'm not going to dwell too much on this. I don't think it's necessary, other than to state the fact. I came from one of those alcoholic homes where there was physical abuse, there was a lot of mental abuse, and in my case, there was sexual abuse. All right. And the reason I bring that up, and the only reason I bring that up, is not because I need your sympathy. That happens to a lot of people. It was a fact of my life. It's one of those things you go on. Okay, but because I have worked with women and men in Alcoholics Anonymous who have said to me, but you don't understand why I can't get this program. You don't know what has happened to me. You don't know where I've been. You don't know what it was like for me as a kid. And I can honestly say to them, yes, I do. And I can honestly say to them, and you can stay sober anyhow. Okay. If you want to use that for a cop-out, go right ahead, but don't tell me. We are not the only ones that those kind of things happen to, and there are millions of people every day that go on with life anyhow. You know. But being that we are alcoholic, any excuse will do, and for many of us, that's been the one we've used. And the reason why I fear that so, my friends, is because, you see, we're dying because of it. We're dying because of it. I am so grateful that when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had sponsors who said, you are responsible. If you go out and drink, girl, don't call back and say it's my fault that I didn't sponsor you correctly. You knew what you were doing when you picked up that drink. It's time for you to grow up. You know, sponsors back then weren't real, real concerned about hurting your feelings. They were cold is what they were. They were a cold bunch. You know, but they were real concerned about you not drinking again. They were real concerned about that. And I think that's real important. I think that's real important. I think sometimes we lose sight of it in Alcoholics Anonymous. The sexual abuse started when I was 9 years old. It ended when I was 16. And it ended because I told him if he ever laid a hand on me again, I'd cut his throat. And he knew and I knew I meant it. There was no doubt in my mind. What I need to tell you about what happened during that relationship, though, was that one night when I was getting beat upon, I picked myself up off the floor, and I said, I don't need to take this anymore, and I didn't, and I started hitting back. Now, up until the time I was about 3 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I absolutely loved a good fight. I just, you know, there was just something that would let go, and if you don't have this problem, you won't understand, and if you do have this problem, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. But if you're addicted to violence like I was, it kind of starts like a real quiet rumble right down here in the tummy, you know, just a real quiet one, and then it just kind of builds up and comes into your throat, and you're not going to be happy until flesh hits flesh, and it's a sickness unto itself, you know. And I was so grateful, you see, and God is so wise, because of one of my sponsors that he put into my life had that same sickness. And he was able to help me get well. He was able to help me get well there. And I started hitting people when I was very young, 14. Now, I was drinking alcoholically, as I know it, when I was 14 years old. I was waiting for the next drink. I was hiding liquor. I was stealing liquor. I absolutely loved the drug alcohol. Just loved it. If alcohol hadn't done the trick for me, I'd have done something else. But you're not going to hear me talk about drugs because I just didn't do it. I tried. In the latter part of my drinking, I ran with people who truly did sell drugs. And I had it, I don't want to say I had it at my disposal free, all I could use. You know that wouldn't be true. They never give that stuff to anybody. But, friends or otherwise. But it never did it, you know. And I remember one morning I was really feeling bad, and one of the guys said, here, take two of these, you'll feel better. And so I took two, and I waited like 5 minutes, and nothing happened. You know, and I'm waiting for something to really grab hold, and nothing happened. And I said, forget it, this won't do, and I went and got my bottle. And for me, whether it was psychosomatic or otherwise, it doesn't really matter, because for me, the minute I had my hand on that bottle, I knew it was going to be better. I knew I was going to be better. Now, it just really, I didn't even have to get the cork off of it, I just knew, you know, I was going to be better. So pills and drugs, I never really got into. Pot always gave me a terrible, terrible headache. You know, and it just, the high just wasn't good enough. And not only that, but you see, when I drank to check out. I didn't drink to get high. I didn't drink to get funny. I didn't drink to laugh. I drank to check out. You know, I was one of those kids in it that was super sensitive about everything, and everything bothered me, and I took everything personal. And I was a child of the 60s, and there was a lot going on in this going on country then that was just horrid, absolutely horrid. And I took it all personally. I don't need to go into the details, but I took it all personally. I took the Vietnam War personally. I took the race riots personally. I took all of it personally. And I just wanted out. I just wanted out. And also the booze did that for me. And it worked so well. It worked so well. And it brought me that peace, and it brought me that quiet, and it got me to the point where I could just say, you know, I just don't care. I just don't care. And you know, you keep telling yourself those lies, and you keep telling yourself those lies, and before too long, you start to believe them, and you start to live them. You know, you just start to live them. After I graduated from high school, which I don't know how I did, and I got myself a job, we were living in Atlanta, Georgia, and that's where I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and frankly, that's where I spent most of my life. Atlanta, Georgia is a wonderful town. It's a wonderful town, but it was very, very good to me. And a wonderful town to stay drunk in, which I did. And I took a lot of geographical cures in Atlanta. You can do that in a city that size. I never really left town. I just kind of moved all around 285, you know. And I'd get in a little trouble on one side of town, and I'd pack up and go to another side of town. But I never really could leave the city. And I don't know what kind of sick allegiance I had there. I just did. I got into a nice little job after I left high school, and the drinking was getting worse. And I wasn't long into the job and long out of high school before I left home. And leaving home, see, my mom, God love her, my mom had always kind of watched over her oldest daughter. And out of the three girls that were living at home, both she and my stepfather said none of them gave us the amount of trouble that I did, you know. And I didn't really mean to do that. I really didn't mean to do that, but that's the way it was. And mom would kind of oversee my drinking. And I can remember when I was just 15 or 16, she pulled me aside and said, Judy, honey, we got to look at your drinking, honey. There's a problem here. There's a problem here. And I, you know, and that's the way we are when we're alcoholics. When we know somebody's on to us, we'll start watching it. You know, and I was still young enough, and I could still control it enough to where, yeah, I'd watch it and I'd make sure. And my mom was drinking at that time, and I thought she was drinking alcoholically, but my mother wasn't drinking alcoholically. My mother came to Alcoholics Anonymous for a couple of months after she quit drinking. She came to Alcoholics Anonymous for a couple of months, and then she never came back. And she never started drinking again. And for a while, that bothered me. I couldn't understand that until I started looking at the things, like Scott was talking about this morning, the threefold. You see, my mother doesn't have all the other things that go along with being an alcoholic. I don't ever remember my mother resenting anybody. I don't ever remember her resenting anybody. I don't ever remember her having all these fears that I seem to have, all the sensitivities that I seem to have. You know, I really think my mother was one of those people the Big Book talks about. She drank, and up until a point when there was a crisis in her life that made her quit, she quit, and she never drank again. And she's a relatively happy woman. I mean, I don't see that she's going through any severe repercussions as a result of it. I do know, however, I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that, you know, that I have to stay here. And I don't mind that at all, because I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I got into that nice little job, and I was drinking, and I was 19, 20 years old, and, you know, if you're Catholic and raised the way I was raised, it's real important that you start thinking about getting married. Because you're supposed to have a lot of kids. And I didn't want to get married. And I didn't want children. And I know now why that is. After taking inventories, I found out why I had that feeling. You see, both of those require responsibility on my part. And I didn't want any responsibility. I didn't want any responsibility. I really did not want to get married. The last thing I wanted to do in my life was take care of a man. And I want to make it real clear up front so that nobody will feel badly. I am not a male basher. I had two addictions. One was booze and the second one was men. Okay? But I just could not see me going through life taking care of a man. I just did not want any part of it. And that's at this time in my life, I just didn't. So I wasn't real concerned, but I would go ahead and get engaged anyway because it made mother not worry so much. And I got engaged quite a bit between 19 and 21. And when you're an active alcoholic and you're so loving as I was, I was drinking so much, and I got confused, and the inevitable happened. I woke up one morning to find myself engaged to two men at the same time. And I procrastinated back then and could not make the decision, you know, as to which one to let go. And then, so I continued to drink, and then I woke up, or went to the door one evening and came to the realization that I had both of them over for dinner the same night. And I really just kind of left and let the two of them work it out, you know. I don't care how good a con you are, there is no talking your way out of that one. They're both standing there, and there's just nothing you can... And, you know, I make light of that today, but I want to let you know that in my sobriety, I have had the opportunity to make amends to one of those men. I haven't been able to find the other one, and they were received very well and very graciously and very lovingly, and it was nice. It was real nice to be able to do that, because I do laugh about it now, but it was not a funny situation. It wasn't even close to being funny then. You know, it was dangerous. And I found myself in those situations a lot, because I would get engaged, and then I'd decide I wouldn't want to get married. And so I'd start running around with married men. And I was one of those women that a lot of us women don't like to hear about, or we don't like to talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I was one of the women that walked into the bar and sized the guys up. And I was the one who walked in and decided which one of them I was going to take home. And that's the way I lived. And I wish I could tell you that I only did that every now and then or every once in a while, but it was every night. And I just fell in love every night. It was real easy for me. You know, I know what they tell us in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't fall in love. I fell in heat. But it nevertheless, you know... That's the way that I lived. And you see, you live that way, and then you couple it with that attitude of, I don't care. I don't care. And you keep telling yourself that. But let me tell you what the paradox is, and where the insanity comes in an alcoholic's mind, is that you say that at 11:30 or 12 o'clock or 1 o'clock in the morning, perhaps, that no, it doesn't matter. No, I really don't care anyhow. You say that. All right, but when you get up the next morning and that head is pounding and it's 5:30 and you're sick to your stomach and you look in the mirror... That's not what you say. That's not what you say. You say to yourself, why did I do it again? Why did I do it again? Why do I do this to myself? Why do I do this to other people? You know, why did I do it again? I knew better. I knew that was not the way to live. You know, I came from a sick family, yes, but for the love of God, we had some kind of morals. You know, I knew what I was doing and the way I was living was wrong. I knew that. No, but I had to keep telling myself I just didn't care. And I take some of that fortifier, and guess what? I just didn't care. And so it went on, and it went on. And you know what would have inevitably happened. It happens to all alcoholics. I couldn't hold that nice little job anymore. And even though I had done very well with that company, I couldn't stay there anymore. And I knew that axe was going to fall right across my neck just any day now. So I went out and got another job. We are very good at that, too. Alcoholics have a keen sense of knowing when we're going to get fired. We know when it's going to happen. And it wasn't that I ever showed up at work drunk. I did not show up at work drunk. It's just that I was out a lot of mornings till 4:30 or 5 o'clock drinking. I had to be at work at 9. And the way I drank, you know, if you drank a quart of bourbon and you go to and you finish that off at 5 o'clock in the morning and you go into work at 9, you still smell like bourbon. I didn't know that. I thought that little four-hour gap there would be enough. But it wasn't, you know, and I got reported for drinking on the job, but they didn't fire me then, but I knew it was coming, so I quit, and I got into the bar and restaurant business, which is just where I needed to be. And I got in there, and I just turned 21. I maintain that being in that business is probably what got me to Alcoholics Anonymous at the age of 23. I really do. And it's not a good business if you're an active alcoholic. It was just crazy. And I wish I could share with you some about it, but I remember very little. I know I stayed drunk most of the time. And I know that there were a lot of days now, even at 21, 22, I did not have enough to get up and get dressed and go to work. There wasn't any strength left anymore. You know, I was not eating on a regular basis. I had no sleeping schedule at all. Some mornings I'd get up and I'd obviously gotten in a fight the night before. And I just couldn't go out there and do it. I just couldn't go, you know. And if any of you have ever been in, women in particular, if you've ever been beat up pretty bad, you know that you got a week, 3 days anyhow, before the makeup will even cover it. Because if you've been beat hard enough, it's 3 days before the swelling goes down. And then there were some mornings I'd wake up and I'd look around and I'd You know, I could tell by the way that I felt and by the way that I looked that I'd gotten into a fight, but I couldn't really remember what it was about, but my apartment would tell me that it was a bad fight. And sometimes there'd be blood in the kitchen sink, and I didn't know whether it was theirs or mine. I just never knew, you know, and that's a lousy way to live. That's an absolute lousy way to live. And I think a lot of times in sobriety, I know for myself, I forget that's where I came from, God forbid. I forget, you know, and it's good for me to do this so that I can remember that one drink, and I'm going right back there, man. I'm going right back there. I got no choice. It's all I know. You know, that's all I know. I don't know how to do it any other way. And the drinking got worse, the problems got worse. There weren't any more sugar daddies. You know, I'd given up on fiancés, and I used to bring sugar daddies in for a month or so to get me caught up on the bills. You know, I don't know if any of you ever did that or not, but it's really quite convenient. But I was getting so bad that, you know, they couldn't even stick around 30 days anymore. I mean, the guys just weren't even coming around, and my violence was getting totally out of hand, and the truth of the matter is I really did scare a couple of them off. I mean, I was just absolutely paranoid. I slept with knives underneath my pillow, underneath my mattress. It was just, I was just nuts. I was absolutely nuts. That was getting tough, and I couldn't get anybody to foot the bill for my behavior anymore, and I was old. I was getting real old. I was 23 now, and I'm tired all the time, and I'm just tired all the time, and I'm tired of fighting this thing, and I ran out of sugar daddies, and I ran out of money, and I ran out of booze, and it all happened at the same time, and that's a bad place to be when you're an alcoholic. And I called a guy I'd met in the restaurant business, and his name was Pearl, and I said, Pearl, I gotta hit some cash, and I gotta have it tonight, because I'm out of booze, man, and I'm out of men. And I went to work for Pearl as a hooker on the streets of Atlanta, because that's what I had to do. And you know, in my tenure in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous since December the 18th, 1972. I don't know if I mentioned that or not, but that is my sobriety date. And in that period of time, there was a long time I never said anything about work in the streets. I really didn't want to get some of the reactions that I have gotten. I had to become spiritually fit first, really, before I could say that, because you see, there's a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, you may not believe this, but it's true, that don't believe that women like me should be here. That we do not represent Alcoholics Anonymous well. I have heard it said that women like me should not tell from the podium that I worked as a hooker. You know, that has no place in Alcoholics Anonymous. You can see that really affected my decision on what to share. And not to discredit or be cruel to anyone, but I find that my biggest critics are those who either had to pay for it or didn't have sense enough to sell it. The moment of silence there was God saying, that's enough, Judy, don't say any more. Oh, God. You know, when you live that kind of life and you're in that, and I don't want to give you all this big picture that I was just some real rough, tough street kid, okay? I couldn't last out there, man. I don't know how these women go out there and work the streets for years. I do not understand. I just don't know, and my heart breaks when I go into a big city and see those girls on the corners. My heart just breaks for them. You know, and some of them, yeah, I can look at them, and I know exactly where they're at. I know exactly where they're at, and I still to this day want to reach out and say, get in the car, girl, and come with me. You don't have to do this anymore. That's what I really want to do, you know. I really want to do that. But I know that just like for me, she's not coming until she's ready, man. And I pray for those babies. I pray for him. I pray for him. And you know, the thing that I think is wonderful, and the reason that I share this, is because I was an Alcoholics Anonymous 6.5 years before I heard a woman tell my story. 6.5 years I sat in an audience like you're sitting, saying, for the love of God, don't tell me there's not one more hooker in here. I can't believe I'm the only one. 6.5 years. And so help me God, as long as I've got breath in me, no other woman or man will sit out there for 6.5 years waiting to hear whether somebody else sold their body for a drink. It will not happen. Now, I want to tell you all that every time before I talk, I always ask God not to let me get opinions into my lead, into my talk. I always ask Him to do that. He has never listened up until this date. Okay. So if you have a problem with some of my opinions, you can take it up with Him tonight. I did all I could. It's a wonder. When all else fails, blame God. It was a sick life. I ended up spending 6 months in a mental hospital on a locked ward. And you know, the irony of that is they never talked to me about my drinking. They never talked to me about my drinking. They went into the stepfather thing a lot and felt sure that if they came to the core of that, they would understand why I did behave the way that I behaved. You know, hitting people and that kind of stuff. They felt like that's where the answer was. You know, they never talked to me about my alcoholism. Never. And I left there AMA. I left there in 1972 on a 3-hour pass, and I'm still on that pass. And one of the best con jobs I ever ran in my life, hands down. It was really a good one. It really was. It was the only time in my drunken life I ever remember getting humble, is when I went to that shrink and asked for just a 3-hour pass, right? And it worked. I left everything there, and I left with a man, of course. How else do you leave town but with a man? Oh. But it was 10 to 14 days later, and I was a sick baby. And 10 to 14 days later, I did what all good alcoholics do. Grown-up alcoholics, I went home to Mama. Sick and battered and bruised and hungover and drunk and stinking because it had been 10 to 14 days since I'd bathed. And I passed out on her couch, and she came home from work, and that's what she found. And a couple of days later, after I was at the point where I could sit up, you know, I just decided it wasn't worth it anymore, and I made an attempt at suicide. And I, too, I'd been diagnosed when they put me in the hospital as suicidal homicidal, which means I don't really care about anybody, you know. I'll blow me away, blow you away. It just really doesn't matter. And at that point in time in my life, as much as I'm afraid to tell you this, that was pretty much true. I just had no regard for human life at all, just none. The whole world was just painful, and it stunk, and I want no part of it. And that's really, really tragic. That's really, really tragic that you get to that point. But anyway, after the suicide attempt, Mom gave me a couple of days to get my act together, and then she threw me out. And to me, at the time, that was the cruelest thing that could ever have happened. I know today that that was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because you see, no matter what, Mama was always there. No matter what. No matter what kind of trouble I got into, Mama was always there. You know, I remember one night I got locked up and she wouldn't come to the jail to bail me out. She sent my stepfather to bail me out. And I said, "Where's Mom?" And he said, "She couldn't make it. She's too upset." You know, and what did I do? I did one of the alcoholic things, right? I rolled my eyes like, "Hey, it's no big deal. I mean, I just got busted. There's nothing wrong here. We'll get out of it," you know, not thinking about what it was doing to others. You know, I was one of those selfish and self-centered alcoholics who said, "I'm only hurting myself. I'm only hurting myself." I never thought about the embarrassment I was causing my two kid sisters. I never thought about the agony I was putting my mother through when she came home and saw me drunk again and again and again. And the times I called her and I was drunk and she knew I was drunk and she couldn't get to me. She didn't know where I was, and God only knows what I said to that poor woman. You know, but yet I stood back and boastfully said, "I'm not hurting anybody but myself." So when she threw me out, it wasn't too much longer. I had to take a look at me. And the last person to come and take care of me in my life was my cousin Joanne. I went to stay with her. She was in Atlanta on a business assignment, was going to be there about 6 months. And she took me in, and God love her, she tried her best. But inside of 3 weeks, she said, "You got to pack your bags and go. I've never seen anybody drink like you." Never. So again, another one who loved me and who had loved me since I was a child had told me, "You got to go. You got to go." And in all my alcoholic arrogance, I whipped around, and you know what I told her, and I'm cleaning it up here because I really don't like talking like that anymore. But I just told her, "I don't need you, and I don't need anybody else. I'll go. What do you think? You're doing me some favor here?" And I walked to that door, and as I told you, it was December, and it was cold in Atlanta. And it hit me, and I know it was God now talking to me. It hit me, "Where are you going to go? Where are you going to go?" And I started thinking about people that would take me in. My pimp was doing time, and so there was no way I was going to be able to run back to him. where was I going to go? I had no friends left. I had burned up, used up, abused everybody that had ever been in my life, and nobody wanted any part of me. Nobody wanted anything to do with me. And there is an emptiness and a loneliness that goes along with that, and just the hopelessness. You have no one. You have no one. And the moment of truth, it was my fault. It was me. I went and turned to my cousin Joe and I said, call AA. Now, I promise you the only thing I learned about or knew about Alcoholics Anonymous was what I saw in a movie one time. I saw this movie about AA. It was about Bill W. It was a real, real, real old movie. No, it wasn't Days of Wine and Roses. It was a real, real, real old movie. Which, you know, when you drink a lot, you sit up and watch the movies, even when it breaks down and goes into a test pattern or just static, you'll sit there and watch it anyhow. But this particular, and I was but a child when I saw this movie. And it was odd that I remembered it, but Joe, my cousin, called Alcoholics Anonymous for me, and I went to my first AA meeting that night, and I got on the phone, and the lady said, how you feeling, honey? And I'd been about 4 hours without a drink. Now you have to understand, I was a daily drinker, and my body clicked off at 4 hours. That meant every 4 hours it was saying, we need a drink, Jude, we need a drink. And if I didn't get one, I would go into shaking, and I would go into seizures. It was not uncommon for me to have convulsions. I got real sick when I went through withdrawal, so I just had a solution. I just didn't withdraw. But eventually you have to. And I was getting, I called her, and or Joe called him for me. And her name was Bunny. I remember this lady. Her name was Bunny, sweet little lady. Now, her name was Ellen. Yeah, her name was Ellen. And she said, how you doing? And I told her I thought I was dying. And I truly did. I really did think I was dying. It was, like I say, 4 hours, and I had nothing in my system. And she told me to drink soft drinks and eat honey and try and get some orange juice down. And I knew the orange juice would never make it, but I thought the honey might work. And the first 3 days I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, I lived on Pepsi Colas and honey. That's all I could eat. That's all I could get to stay down. I was real weak, and I was real sick, and I was old. I was 20. Is somebody else pulling on the end of this thing? Is he trying to tell me something, do you suppose? Yeah. I was 23 years old, and I was worn out. I was absolutely worn out. I was 23 years old, and I felt like I'd fought an 80-year war out here. And I had no strength left, and I had no drive left, and I didn't want to push anymore, and I just didn't care anymore. I was just worn out. And she told me that the people would be by about 7:15 to pick me up to go to my first AA meeting. And I started getting ready at 5. My cousin had to help me get in and out of the tub because I didn't have the strength to do that on my own. She had to help me bathe and put on clothes. I tried to put on makeup, which is a trick. Have you ever tried to put on eyeliner when you got shakes? Yeah. I had it up underneath the eyebrow, over the eyebrow. But I was going to go looking good. You know that. Had to look good. And I went, the 12 step call is marvelous. It's absolutely marvelous. Looking back, it was just perfect. The first one to walk in was that, thank you, honey. The first one to walk in was one of the best looking men I'd ever seen in my life. Absolutely glorious. I can still remember him. He was tan and he had just a little bit of gray hair and he had a nice white shirt. And I often say you could tell by looking at him, he showered every day. He was just that kind of guy, you know. Real class act, you know. And he walked in and I thought, now this AA thing might not be too bad. You know what I'm saying, Georgia, you know. But right behind him came Rebecca Sunnybrook Farm. Now you have to understand, I got on black hip boots. And I had long black stringy hair, was always hung over my eye, and I always had a cigarette hanging out of my mouth, always. I carried on a conversation with it in there. I never took a cigarette out. That was my sign to you, you are dealing with a tough broad, okay? Always kept a cigarette hanging out of the corner of my mouth. and I got that hair hanging over the eye, that cigarette hanging out of the mouth, and I got one leg thrown over one arm of the chair, and here she comes. And she is grinning from ear to ear. Okay? She's got on these cute little pearl earrings, not a hair out of place. Okay, little brown princess coat with the velvet collar. And she reaches out that hand and says, "Hi, my name is Bunny." Oh, my God. And I remember looking at Joe, and Joe was looking at me, and she was saying with her eyes, "You are going anyhow." She knew exactly what I was thinking, because I didn't want anybody seeing me with this woman named Bunny. But I went to my first AA meeting, and I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I truly did, and I'll tell you why. It's because of what I'm hearing today. And it always does it, every time. When I hear the laughter in Alcoholics Anonymous, I fall in love with this program all over again. All over again. The laughter I once heard, someone once told me, the laughter in AA is the soul music of AA, and I truly believe that. I truly believe that. It is when I hear you laugh, I get warm all over. You know, I did it the first meeting, and I do it today. And it is so wonderful. It is so wonderful. And the meeting was in a church, and that made me nervous, but I went in anyhow. You know, my sweet little Polish grandmother used to say about sinners, if she ever goes back to church, the roof will cave in. And I was not feeling good, and that kept going over and over and over in my mind. But I went to my first AA meeting, and then they did those wonderful things that old-timers used to do. They gave me phone numbers, unsolicited. They didn't wait to see what I was dressed like. They didn't wait to see what I walk like or what I talk like. They came up and said, "Here's my phone number. Give me a call." It was all women. All women did this, which was really weird to me, really strange. You know, and try as I might to get numbers from the guys, they wouldn't let them up. They wouldn't give them up. Jeez, what a weird bunch. I mean, I wasn't planning on charging them or anything, you know. I was going to this meeting, and I'm raised on the good side of town, right? And the things that you're supposed to do, the right and proper and good stuff, which is really, really important to some people. But when I walked back in there after living the way I had lived for as many years as I had lived that way, I didn't fit back into that side of town anymore. My talk, my mannerisms, my way of life was not what was going on there. And I even knew that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I mean nothing, and I truly do mean nothing to the women of that group when I came in. I don't think they deliberately meant to make me feel different. If anything, quite the contrary. They did give me their phone numbers. And I tried. But I started feeling like, I don't belong in this group. I don't belong in this group. Because see, these were ladies that never cussed. Okay? And they always wore nice little skirts and stuff, you know? And I mean, if I didn't own a pair of jeans that you didn't have, you have to have a pair of pliers to put them on. I mean, that's the way I dressed. You know, and most of them were satin or leather. I mean, it was not dainty feminine stuff. And I'm going into this meeting, and I'm feeling out of sorts. I'm not feeling like I belong. And one lady in all her wisdom saw this. And she told me of another group. She said, "Judy, I think you really might enjoy this group." And I went to that group, and it was the Atlanta Biscayne, and it was located in Chamblee. And there were a bunch of people there like me. Now, there still weren't a lot of women like me. There was only one woman there who cussed a lot. But I was glad to see her. Believe me, I was real glad to see her. You know, but there were a lot of guys there, and they were the kind of guys that I used to drink with, and the kind of guys that I used to fight with, and the kind of guys, you know, that I knew. I knew these guys. You know, and I felt like I was at home here. And let me tell you something about this. This is wonderful. There were two men in this group. One was Big Jim and one was Dad. And these were the men that were to become my sponsors. And I know some people in Alcoholics Anonymous don't agree that men should sponsor women. But I'm here to tell you, if it hadn't been for those two men, I truly believe I'd have died my first 2 years. You know, I never would have made this program. Because for whatever reason God decided they were supposed to, they took me under their wing, and they raised me in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, they raised me, and they loved me, and they were kind, and they spent time with me, and they talked with me. And I also want to share with you that not for 1 minute did those guys think there were 13 steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've gotten some slack because I've sponsored some men in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't have any problem with that. And if it bothers you, that really is your problem. I know what my motives are. If you want to doubt them, go ahead and doubt them. It just means too much to me, because, and I know I've worked with women in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm here to tell you, sometimes we can't go to another woman. And I'll tell you why I couldn't go to another woman, okay? Because none of these gals would ever be around me if they knew what I really was. None of them. So there's just no sense in trying to strike up a relationship with her and her and her and her, because as soon as she finds out I work the streets, man, she's going to drop me like a hot potato. I've been there. I know that. That's what's going to happen. Okay? But the guys that were there, they're more understanding. The guys that were there were more understanding, and I could talk to them easier. I drank with men. I fought with men. You know, I was more comfortable with them. Was I running a con on them? No, I don't think so. By the time I got here, I was too sick to run cons. I was just too sick. I was so afraid that if you all found out what I had done and what I had become, you were going to throw me out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and where else would I go? If you throw me out, where am I going to go? I got no place else to go. I can't even go to my mother's house, for God's sake. Where am I going to go? I held on to this because it's all I had. And my frustration today sometimes gets so bad because I see people coming in and going out and coming in and going out, you know? Like this is some kind of game. Wake up, folks. Alcoholism kills. Alcoholism will kill you. And if you detect anger, you're right. Because I'm tired of burying you. I had a guy in my area in Ohio, in and out, and in and out, and in and out. And he asked me, Judy, would you sponsor me? And I said, yeah, I'll sponsor you. I always get the sick ones. Of course I'll sponsor you. You know, and we started working together, and there were a lot of dark secrets back in his past, and he was having a real hard time dealing with it. And he kept going out and drinking, and I kept saying, baby, you know, just don't drink. Let's just keep it with you. You're just like me, honey. All I can pray for out of you is that you don't drink and keep breathing for the first year. I'm not going to ask any more than that out of you. You know, and that's all Big Jim and Dad asked out of me. Don't drink and keep breathing, sweetheart. You know, they knew I was going to come back. This was the only place I had to go. They started talking to me about change. And David tried. I got to tell you, David did try. But one more time he got out of detox. One more time he went into one of those relapses. Only this time David blew his brains out. Okay, and I had to go to that funeral home, and I had to see that beautiful, glorious human being there. No, because he forgot this disease kills. This disease kills. And I looked at his two little daughters, and I looked at his wife, and what do you say? You know, don't ever believe you can always come back. Don't buy that for one minute. That beer that you're going to pop and toss down may be your last one. Because I will promise you, when David drank the last time, I don't think that's what he had in mind. But you know, we're alcoholic and we black out. Okay. And I've lost too many, and it's just too painful. Anyway, I get into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got these two sponsors, and one's a real big, big man, and he's scary is what he is. You know, and I never feared much, but he was a huge man. His nickname was Big Jim, and he was appropriately named, and he had a voice that would boom. He was a man of few words, and he used them well. I know. And then there was Dad, and Dad was a little bantamweight man, meaner than a snake. I always said, Dad, if I ever get drunk again and get in another fight, I want you on my side, man. And Dad was the one that helped me with that temper, and he started telling me about those things to do, you know, when I wanted to go out and hit somebody. And I remember one time I came into the room, and I said, Dad said, where are you going, Judy? And I said, I'm see that woman back there? And I didn't call her a woman, but that'll do for today. And he said, yeah. I said, I'm going to take her outside. I've had it with her. I said, it's her mouth, man. She runs it all the time, and I'm sick of it. So we're going to go outside. We're going to get this straightened out. Dad looked me right in the eye and he said, get a cup of coffee and sit down. Sponsors talked to you that way back then. They really did. And I did exactly what he said. I got that coffee and I sat down. And he took that little finger of his, which he was a master at, and he poked it right at me. And he said, Judy, if you're going to stay sober, you've got to quit hitting people. Hitting people is not socially acceptable behavior. And see, when you're rum dumb and you're new like me, this was all news to me. It was socially acceptable where I came from. And God love him. And then he gave me a gift that I give to you, because I've used it many times. And he said, Judy, you can't act like a drunk and expect sobriety. And it hit. It hit that in those early months in my sobriety, I was still trying to be the tough little mean little broad that nobody was going to hurt. And now that's what I was trying to do. And that this was a program of change. And that's what Dad told me. He said, you got to change, baby. You have got to change. And so I did. I got married. I'm 3 months sober. I decide it's time to get married. Newcomer thinking, man, it's deadly, deadly. I decided it's time to get married, and I found a... It's not hard to find a husband in Alcoholics Anonymous, by the way. So I found a husband, and at 4 months sobriety, I was married, and my spouse had 5 months sobriety. So we got two newcomers striking out in this world. And the deacons in my group just kind of sat back and picked it as their favorite entertainment, you know? Just... I really think we increased the attendance at meetings just to see what those two are going to do this time. We decided to move to Hiawassee, Georgia, which is a very, very tiny, itty-bitty little town I had no business in. I've been asphalt and concrete all my life. I have no idea how to live in a small country community. I didn't know anything about it. I move up there. I wasn't one of those that came in and got a real good job right up front and got nice clothes and, you know, started living like a lady. So I move up into this small country Church of God community, and I'm shouting that street trash talk, you know. And I'm dressed in those clothes that I wore when I worked 10th and Peach Street. It's all I had. And people looked at me funny. I just could not fit in. I just could not fit in. It was very difficult. The meetings were not numerous up there, and there wasn't a lot of AA activity up there, and it was hard for me. And what was good about that is I got to get into Alcoholics Anonymous in the books and in the literature, and I'm very, very grateful for that, because that's what kept me going. I read Came to Believe, and I read the 12 and 12, and I don't know how many times I read Came to Believe, but I got a hold of Alcoholics Anonymous literature, and that's what really kept me going for about 9 months. And it was a difficult time for me, and I remember my ex and I had a fight up there, and it was horrid. It was absolutely horrid, and I'd never really had any real, real pain in sobriety before, not emotional pain, but now I was getting sober enough now to where I could start feeling pain, you know. And I was sitting by a lake, and I was crying because of this fight. And up until this point in time, I had no use for God. I really didn't care about God, and kind of made an agreement with him years back. You stay out of my stuff, I stay out of your stuff, and everything's cool. You know, that's kind of the way I felt towards God. But this time now I'm hurting, you know, and I'm not drinking, and I got no junk in my veins or anything. I'm just fine. And I'm sitting there, and I'm remembering, I'm crying, and I'm thinking, God, I don't know if you're up there. Because I was sitting next to this lake, and there's a mountain behind the lake. And I said, God, I don't know if you're up there, and I don't know if you can hear me. But I got to have some relief, or I'll drink again. And I don't want to drink again. And I will share with you that everything got real, real quiet and calm. And it was like there was a good friend of mine sitting next to me who patted me on the shoulder and said, you're going to be okay, kid. You're going to be okay. And now when I loved it this morning when Scott kept talking about saying, a child of God. Because when I got up from that little hillside sitting next to that lake, I was a child of God. For the first time in my life, I was a child of God. For the first time in my life, I knew... Thank you. For the first time in my life, I knew that as a child of God, I had the right to be happy. I had the right to have a good life. For the first time, I knew, I truly knew that my Heavenly Master loved me. And I had never known that. I had never known that. You know, all I'd ever felt was condemnation. That's all I'd ever known. You know, I was never good enough. I was never right enough. I was never smart enough. I was never enough until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I don't want to tell you then that life got good and I just went on this spiritual journey and everything's been wonderful since. That's not what happened. That's not what happened. I've gone through a lot of pain. I went through a lot of pain. And I want to share some of this too, because I am so nosy that when people stand up here and they say, I've been through a lot of rough times in my sobriety, I want to know. What kind of rough times have you been through? Are you talking a flat tire or what are you talking here? I don't know. You know, I'm going to tell you that if you're between 3 and 4 years sobriety and you're sitting out there and you're thinking about suicide, you are okay. Okay? You are okay. You are not flunking AA. I sat out there and I had to look at, here's sobriety and here's drunkenness, man, and I'm not real sure which one's going to win out. No, I was not always kind to the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. There were days when I dared you to talk to me. Say one word to me about the big book and I'm going to give you a new purpose for it, my friend. You know? The anger was incredible. Now, if you are, and I mean that seriously, if you're sitting out there and you're thinking about suicide and you've got 3, 4, or 5 years sobriety, that because I went through it all those years, you know, and it was not now constant, but it would come back. It is okay. You see, what we have to realize, and even though you don't want to admit it, you're getting better because you're thinking about suicide. You're not thinking about drinking. True. It is true. For the alcoholic to think about anything other than a drink to solve his problems is getting better. Now, it's not healthy thinking. Okay? It is not healthy thinking, and of course you want to go and get help, and let's get to the real root of the problem. But all I want to do here is give you some comfort and say that this will pass, because it did for me. And there have been times in my sobriety, and the only thing I know now that's different about when I was a year sober versus being 20-some years sober is that the bad times don't dig as deep and don't stay as long, but they still come. You know, it's just that I don't have to wallow in it and have to learn about what to do about it and call my sponsor 50,000 times. No, I don't have to do that anymore because I've got my own track record. You know, and the whole purpose of us getting up here and doing this is for the newer people in Alcoholics Anonymous. What I'm saying to you is that, honey, if you don't have your own track record, you can borrow mine. Go ahead and use mine. You know, because the program does work, and eventually the day will come when you've got your own track record you can fall on and say, hey, I got through this sober. See, because when I got through that divorce from that first husband sober, I felt a new bit of strength. I thought, I went through that, man, and I didn't drink. I didn't drink. You know, and that was something great for me because I never went through anything and didn't drink. And that was really emotional for me. It was really difficult, and I felt pain for the first time in years. I felt pain. You know, and let me tell you something about pain. It hurts, but that's it. It won't kill you. You don't have to drink. And it will pass. It will pass. I got married again to my husband, Craig. We got married in 1976. And this has been a wonderful marriage. My husband and I have had a lot of fun together. We are good friends. And it's been good. The marriage overall has been good. But I want to share with you here, it hadn't been easy. Okay, it just hasn't been easy, but nothing that's really worth anything is easy, you know. My husband Craig and I got together. We both got good jobs, and God was blessing us much and loving us much, and He still does. And we bought a home, you know, did the stuff you're supposed to do. You know, you get married and live in an apartment, well, buy a house. It was really neat. I mean, in a suburb, you know. That was nice, and we were both active in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've had some good jobs, and then Craig got real sick, and Craig drank. Craig had 10 years sobriety. He drank intermittently before that, but the one at 10 years, I think, probably tore me up the worst. I will share with you that I am not a good Al-Anon. I'm a much better alcoholic. I just did not do well with it, and I want to tell you that my Al-Anon brothers and sisters mean much to me. Because when it finally got out, I love AA. It just cracks me up. I go to a meeting, and I'm there on one side of Atlanta the day that I found out Craig was drinking. And I'm there, and before I got home, the whole AA population knew that my husband was drinking. You know, so that old adage of what you say here, make it stay here. Forget it, for the love of God. The government ought to employ Alcoholics Anonymous just to get the news around, you know. And I say this with no sarcasm at all meant. it was concern. I will promise you that that was spread as quickly as it was spread because of the love in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I mean that. I mean, it was going to be known anyhow, you know. I don't know why people try and cover it up. It's going to be known anyhow. But what was wonderful is that the next day, or that night when I got home and found out he had left, and he said he didn't think he would be back, and he left a note on the kitchen table and said, "I'm going to get drunk." And I knew it was coming. It was just a matter of time. You know, we precede. I mean, we get drunk way before we pick up the drink, and I knew it was coming. But I just didn't deal well with it. And he had been very, very physically ill and had just had major surgery on his back. And it was a 50-50 chance that he would ever walk again. And he's diabetic. And a diabetic has no business drinking, let alone drinking alcoholically. And I was very, very concerned. And I called a friend of mine in the program, a young man that I sponsored, and he called his wife, who was an active member of Al-Anon, and she was at my house in 10 minutes. And he was in there shortly thereafter. Just as soon as he got off of work, he came in. And he looked over at me and he said, "Get dressed," because I was just in my, you know, sweats or something. He said, "We're going out to eat, and then we're going to a meeting." I said, "Wait a minute. I am your sponsor. You don't talk to me that way." So I got dressed and we went out to eat, and then we went to a meeting. And we're sitting there, and I was supposed to speak in Columbus, Ohio at the time, and I remember saying, you know, I don't know whether I should call him in Columbus and tell him I can't make it or what. And this is when your own words come back to haunt you. I hate it when they listen this good. Because, you know, he says to me, "What did you teach us about integrity? Didn't you tell me that integrity is doing what you say you're going to do?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Did you tell those people in Columbus that you would be there?" And so I went. I went. I had no idea where Craig was. He was drinking somewhere. But, you know, he'd have been drinking somewhere if I'd have been in Columbus, Ohio, or Atlanta, Georgia. It really didn't make a whole lot of difference. No. The Al-Anons came by. They took me to meetings. They talked with me. They gave me a lot of tools to work with in Alcoholics Anonymous and in Al-Anon. And I am eternally grateful. They never, ever were cold. They never were condescending. They were loving and kind. And I am so grateful. And when Craig decided he wanted to get sober again, and he lived through it, and he came back, and my husband Craig's got almost 6 years now, thank God. Thank God in Alcoholics Anonymous. No. Thank you. And I want to tell you what I learned about that, because, boy, I'm really running the mouth today, was that, you know, I found out that I really, really loved my husband. But I can't stand the disease. You know, I was able, through the help of the women and men in Al-Anon, to divide the two. Because, you see, my husband is a very strong and gentle and kind and caring and easygoing man. No, but he picks up the drink and I don't even like him. No, and I was able to separate the two. And it was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful to be able to do that. It was great when he came home, and after he'd been sober about 3 days, he said, "What are you going to do, Jude?" I said, "I don't know. I'd already been in touch with Pam, that's our attorney, and I said, I don't know what I'm going to do. I have no idea what I'm going to do. You know, right now is not a good time to make a decision. That's what the Al-Anons told me. You know, and so I didn't make a decision, and I said, I think we'll just take it one day at a time, and we've been taking it one day at a time. And like I said, we've been married since 76, and I never thought that was going to happen. You see, there's a lot that's happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous I never thought was going to happen. Through a series of events, we left Atlanta and we moved up to Ohio and we bought an old farmhouse. I came out of the suburb and went into a farmhouse that's 125 years old and doesn't have a level floor or wall in it. And it is just a wonderful place. It's out in the country. And I love it. I absolutely love it. And it's a big change for me, and there were a lot of things that had to change. And I'm now, I sell real estate for a living. If you're sick and twisted in the mind, maybe you'll understand. This just does not make sense. Okay, now this was a girl who worked the streets in Atlanta who is now selling farms. It should not happen. Okay, it should not happen. I know, I couldn't believe, I mean, I go in there and show people, you know, barns, and we walk the acreage. We haven't done much walking. 2.5 feet of snow will kind of slow down your walking acreage, but it's been a slow winter. But it nevertheless is just something that I really enjoy doing. I got to tell you quickly before I close here about my mother and myself. My mother, the mother that threw me out, you know. And I want to tell you about some of the things that I remember about staying sober and why I stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got, right before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was running with a married man, in between running with single ones, and I remember I was sitting in his car, and his sister came out of the car, and she said, "Don't you get out of that car. I don't want my children to see a woman like you. Don't get out of that car." And of course, you know, I sputtered back some profanity at her, and I rolled the window up, and she walked off, and the first thing I did was reach under that seat and get that bottle out, because that's where my relief was, and that's the only way I could cope with what she had just said to me. It's the only way I could do it. And I tipped that bottle up and it all went away one more time. It all went away. You know, and when I would get drunk, a lot of times I'd see Mom standing there at that kitchen door saying, "You get out of here and don't you come back. You're not welcome in this home anymore." You know, and I remember that. And I remember the morning I got up and I needed cigarettes and I was too sick and I really needed to go get cigarettes. And I went to get dressed and I put on one different shoe for each foot, and I went and threw a dress on and I didn't even zip it up the back, and it was on inside out. And I'd gotten drunk the night before and there was mud and blood all over the front of this dress, and I mean it soaked through. It was just a mess, and I'm walking down the street like that going to get a pack of cigarettes, and some strange lady came up to me and said, "Honey, I need to zip your dress up for you before you go any further." I said, "Just leave me alone. Just leave me alone." You know, because I had to go get my cigarettes. And then that's what I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous. And then, you see, I remember also a young lady after I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and was here about 10 years. Oh, did you get that Kleenex? Thank you. That's close enough. And I was in here about 10 years, and she called me and she said, "Judy, if anything happens to me, will you take my son?" And that doesn't happen to women like me. You know, people don't ask women like me to raise their kids should something happen to them. This doesn't happen. My mom and I are driving around the city of Atlanta one day, and the car was quiet. And for no reason, Mom reaches over and she pats me on my shoulder and she said, "You're a good daughter, Judy, and you're a good person, and Mama loves you very much." And that doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. You see, because I just didn't think Mother would ever take me back again after what I had done. Some horrible things. I had done some horrible things, period. If you think I've taken the fifth step up here, think again. You know, even the book tells me to use some discretion, for God's sake. You know, and it's just incredible. It is just incredible. You know, the fact that I walked down the same street in Atlanta, or close to it, that I walked down in that dirty, bloody dress. And 12 years later, I was carrying a briefcase and wearing a three-piece suit because I was made Southeastern Regional Manager for an information processing company in Atlanta. And that's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. If Alcoholics Anonymous has given me anything, it has given me the ability to love. You see, because that man that I'm married to, I truly loved him. And I can tell you honestly, no doubt in my mind, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was not capable of loving. I was not capable about caring about you or anybody else but me. I had no idea what it meant. That's why it galls me when I hear people say AA is a selfish program. That is not in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA is not a selfish program. If anything, it's just the opposite. It tells you over and over and over, it tells me over and over and over again, get out of yourself, get out of yourself, get out of yourself. And in doing that, we are the ones that are richly rewarded. You know, we are the ones that are richly rewarded. I am sometimes troubled a little bit about what I hear now. I'm floating around in rooms, and I don't know where it comes from because it is not in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was talking to a girl I sponsor in Cincinnati the other day, and she has to have major, major back surgery, big-time stuff. I mean, we're talking maybe she'll walk, maybe she won't. And the girl is in incredible pain, just incredible pain. And she called someone and said, since I am on this pain medication, I cannot drive. Will you take me to a meeting? The woman on the other end of the phone said, if you are on pain medication, you do not belong in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Now, I'm going to tell you, if you read your big book, it says we are not doctors. Okay. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous an epileptic. I have grand mal seizures, which means I lose total control of everything, man, everything. I am on a medication that some of you would consider an addictive drug. It doesn't do a thing for me other than what it's supposed to. If you think for 1 minute I'm going to come off of that medication and pop my spine and lose my job and lose my driver's license just so I can appease some of you jokers who think you're doctors, think again. Where do we get off doing this? This is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who is asking for help, who says, I need a meeting. I am in pain. And she said, you can't come to a meeting because you're taking a pain pill. I swear to you, I talked in Virginia, West Virginia, somewhere, and I mentioned about not smoking. A man with 35 years sobriety came up to me after the meeting, and he said, I don't think you've been sober as long as you say you've been sober. I think you got sober when you put those cigarettes down. Up until then, as far as I'm concerned, you weren't sober. He hasn't read his book either. Read your book. It's in there. They talk about cigarettes and smoking. It's in there. It's in there. You think I'm going to tell you? No way. Read it. We're here for alcoholism. Okay? We are here for alcoholism. My desire to quit smoking was because I had no breath left. You cannot walk 165 acres if you can't breathe, you know? I'm telling you, if they come out with them tomorrow where I can smoke them and still breathe, I'm back on them in a minute. I loved every cigarette I ever smoked, just like drinking. Loved every drink I ever took. Did what I needed to do, you know? But we need to get our priorities here. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. You want to loan me that book you're going to give me at the end of the meeting? I've been threatening her for the past 2 days, today and yesterday. Because, see, I got something on her now, and I told her that if she didn't give me a nice introduction, I was going to tell all of you. This is my favorite paragraph. There's a lot of paragraphs in the big book that I love, but this is my favorite. And, again, I tell you, if you don't know where it is, please read the book till you find it. But I close with it as often as I can. And it says, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you very much for your attention.